Good evening. Glad you're here. Welcome to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. My name is Larry Allums. I'm the executive director of the Institute. We're very pleased to have you with us tonight for this special program presented by the Dallas Morning News in partnership with the University of Dallas and the Dallas Institute. Many of you I know are here for the first time. Welcome. And I invite you to take the materials, the printed materials about the Institute, on the entrance table back there and see what we do here. I'd like you to know. To get us into the program, I want to call Mr. Rudy Bush to the podium, a graduate of the University of Dallas in 1997 with a BA degree in English. Rudy is now deputy editorial page editor at the Dallas Morning News. Rudy.
Thank you so much, Larry, for that introduction, for hosting us this evening at the Dallas Institute, continuing your tradition of fostering ideas and dialogue in our community and beyond. I'm grateful we're gathered this evening for an important discussion on dialogue and on the sharing of ideas as a society and, crucially, in our institutions of higher education. None of us are naive to the difficulty these days of having honest, deep, and thoughtful consideration of ideas. We need only open our phones or flip on our computers to be reminded. And in few places, it seems, has the antipathy towards constructive dialogue been so pronounced as on some of our college campuses. Our speakers this evening know a great deal about the struggle of educating our young people in the current age and guiding them in the best American tradition of speaking fearlessly. And it's my honor, my privilege, to introduce our speakers now. Dr. Thomas Hibbs is the president of the University of Dallas, my proud institution, where I also serve as director of journalism, I'm pleased to say. He's also dean emeritus of the Honors College at Baylor University. He's a renowned scholar with a focus on St. Thomas Aquinas, on whom he's authored three books. Dr. Allison Stanger is the Russell Lang Professor of International Politics and Economics at Middlebury College, and she is also visiting professor of government, at Harvard University, along with many other honors and positions, too many to list here. Importantly, though, this evening, she is also the author, the very timely author, of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. And I'm pleased to tell you that after the event this evening, Dr. Stanger will remain to sign copies of her book, which are for sale. So we invite you to participate in that. So join me, please, now in welcoming Dr. Thomas Hibbs and Dr. Allison Stanger.
I think this is the best salesmanship, is to have the book sitting right here, the whole time that we're up
it's
here.
It's got a good cover.
It does have a great cover.
Allison, thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure.
Larry and everybody at the Dallas Institute, Claudia and everyone else, thank you for hosting us. Rudy, thanks to you and the Dallas Morning News for agreeing that this was an important topic that we ought to be taking up. I want to say a few words before we start, and then I'm going to mainly pose questions to Allison, who has done a lot of thinking about these matters, a lot of speaking. We'll get round to whistleblowers toward the end. It's not only an important and the applause and laughter that went out. What great timing. This was not written in the last 2 months. It was written over a number of years and came out just a few months ago. But what great timing. I'm going to have you give me a book idea.
Yeah,
I want to ride the next wave. So it's actually hard to believe. We were talking over dinner earlier that I said, was it really just about a year ago that we had the Kavanaugh hearings? Seems like we've been through about 10 years of public politics since last fall. We did an event in D.C. with Allison and Jonathan Haidt and Robbie George and some others in the spring about rational disagreement. And it's interesting that toward the end of the Supreme Court nomination hearings for Brett Kavanaugh a year ago, Jonathan Haidt tweeted, If you're wondering why American democracy seems to have decayed so quickly, the graph below gives a big part of the story. When groups hate each other, they more easily believe that the ends justify the means. The graph that's in this tweet illustrated the sharp rise in affirmative responses to the question, do you hate members of the opposed political party? That is the party that you're not a member of. And it was pretty evenly split between Democrats and Republicans in this survey. Now, in the early 1980s, only 15% of Americans said, yes, I hate members of the other political party. That remained fairly constant until about 2008, when it started up. And in recent years, it has peaked at just about 50% of Americans who, when surveyed, said, yes, I hate members of the opposed political party. In a subsequent tweet, not long after that, I appealed to citizens concerned about our democracy to support various projects aimed at restoring civil discourse. Mm-hmm. Now, if you read the subtweets into that tweet, the comments that followed, if they're any indication, then the goal of promoting civil discourse has its work cut out for it, because people said, no, thank you, and you're an idiot, and I hate you. And our public culture is indeed characterized by those two features. We think that people who disagree with us are both stupid and malicious. And universities, which should model for, as Rudy mentioned, the public order and the wider culture, disagreement that is both rational and civil, have too often become places where debate is shunned and where versions of the two-minute hate, you remember this in Orwell's 1984? The two-minute hate, where they're looking at an opponent speaking and they hiss and howl. Too often that's the character of discourse. Books are being written and eagerly discussed about these matters. On the right, there's Ben Sasse's Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal. Arthur Brooks's How Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. And on the left, Brookings scholar Darrell West, Divided Politics, Divided Nation. There are all sorts of issues pertaining to this topic. Mm-hmm. Some of them having to do with universities, some of them have to do with the wider culture, some of them having to do with social media. Philosophers like to debate about whether there can really be such a thing as rational disagreement. So they puzzle over, could you have two people who are equally informed and equally good and look at the same evidence and come up with rival points of view? Philosophers are tempted to say somebody's making an error in their reasoning somewhere. But rational disagreement does seem to happen, and we aspire to it. And there's a question as to why we're interested in rational disagreement, why we want civil discourse. We're going to get into all those things. Mm-hmm. I want to start, and Allison is so wonderful to be with us when, and we will talk about the book a little bit later, when she's being hounded by the media because of the book to comment on each move in the gamesmanship in D.C. and across the culture, to take time to be with us here tonight. She gave a wonderful talk out of the book today at the University of Dallas. But you've become connected to these debates over college campuses, yep, because of an event that that occurred at your own school, at Middlebury College, when you agreed to have a discussion, even a debate with Charles Murray, who was visiting. Tell us a little about what happened and what lessons you think you've derived from it and what we can derive from it.
Yeah, well, thank you all for coming out this evening. It's wonderful to be here. And we were just talking at dinner about the Middlebury experience, and it hasn't even really been in my mind recently because I've been out talking about my book. In fact, it's striking to me that when I speak about the book, no one's really made the connection. So congratulations, Dallas, you've made the connection. Yeah, which is good, because these two issues are connected. But just to refresh your memory, on March 2nd, 2017, a student organization on campus who had invited Charles Murray to speak asked me to moderate because they knew it was going to be controversial. And they said, you know, why don't you ask the first three or four questions to get things going? And so being the diligent academic that I am, I read everything. I took pages and pages of notes. I had killer questions. This is going to be a really great exchange. And if you read anything about it, it's an exchange that sort of didn't happen because the event was shut down by students. You can see all this if you want to, you know, have your own two-minute hate, because it's sort of appalling to watch the video of what happened. Administrators read the rules to the students about what you were supposed to do, how you could protest without disrupting the event, because universities should be a place where there's free expression. And what you see is the students just systematically violate those rules that had been read to them by administrators. This went on for 20 minutes. The event was officially shut down, but the administration and I had a contingency plan. We kind of put on a radio-free Middlebury version of this event from a location in the building. We simulcast it. We webcast it and tried to continue. This enraged the protesters. They started setting off fire alarms. And you can watch the video of this, too. It's kind of funny because they had this noise reduction technology. So you can't really hear what we were hearing at the time. It's muted. But it was absolutely terrifying. We're trying to have a discussion, and protesters were banging on the windows, trying to get in. Fire alarms are going off. But we did. We continued. We had the conversation. Not the one I would have liked to have had. It was not the best circumstances for, you know, a good conversation. But because it went forward when we left the building, a mob of some outside agitators, but students had invited them in, surrounded Charles Murray. He was about to fall to the ground. He's a 74-year-old man, so they weren't really going after me at this point, but what would you do if you saw a 74-year-old man about to fall to the ground? Yeah, I took his arm. Terrible, terrible mistake, but I would still always do it, and that enraged the protesters, and they turned on me. So one yanked my hair, another one slammed in the other direction, and I wound up with whiplash and a concussion. The whiplash because we got into the car and the protesters were crawling on the car, banging on the windows. And I don't know why I'm recounting all this. You probably didn't know about it, so it was sort of a terrifying thing. And I guess what I would say about that is my behavior throughout that event was totally consistent with my teaching principles leading up to that event. So when I look back on it, what the lessons are, I wouldn't do anything differently. I really wouldn't do anything differently. I think it illustrates how dangerous it is. Those of you who are authority figures, with children or otherwise, if you tell somebody what the rules are and they violate them, you better have some serious ideas about what the consequences are going to be, or your authority is going to be compromised. But I wouldn't change anything I did, but I would say that's not to say that I didn't learn something from the experience, because it was really kind of a trauma response on the part of some of these students to this man coming on campus and what he represented. It didn't have anything to do with the arguments. It had to do with what he represented. So one of the things I learned was a bit more about scientific racism in this country. I don't know if any of you know about this, but I'm coming from Harvard. It really is the case that very prominent scientists, the world's best scientists, had these crazy theories called polygenism, which were suggesting that something went, you know, that the races were different from the beginning, and so therefore slavery was a response to natural inequality. And they dressed it up with the best of science. I mean, these were some of the smartest people in the United States, Benjamin Pierce, Louis Agassiz. And so that's what Charles Murray reminds them of.
Say a little about what his views actually are.
Yeah, what his views actually... But see, this is the thing that's interesting. It's really kind of a trauma response.
Because he's a conservative author.
Yeah, he's a conservative author. He wrote a controversial book 25 years ago called The Bell Curve. He was coming to speak on another book, Coming Apart, which was is a pretty good elucidation of the Trump phenomenon and the kind of marginalization of whites in America who also feel disempowered. But students didn't want him speaking on campus because of what he had said 25 years ago. But he is a well-respected person in the Republican Party. So from my perspective, if we're a Department of Political Science and we can't have Republicans speak on campus, well, we're not doing our job. We're just a department of indoctrination rather than somebody, you know, a place where ideas can be debated vigorously. But because he talked in those categories, even though he didn't say, if you actually read him, he wasn't saying the things that the Southern Poverty Law Center was saying he had said.
Right.
They played a big role in this, if you're familiar with them. Mm-hmm. They had a website that said he was a white nationalist. It consisted of poll quotes that were pulled out of context. If you read them in context, it often meant just the opposite of what he was actually arguing. And so this just should be a lesson to everybody out here, that when someone throws a headline or a poll quote at you, go back to where it comes from and see it in context, because when we see things in context, they often look very, very differently.
So I remember reading, you wrote two pieces in the New York Times about this.
Yeah.
Event, and the one that I read and remember and have quoted often when talking about these issues on college campuses is where you said that the thing that struck you about the mob, the audience that was protesting, is that none of them would look you in the face, look you in the eyes.
Yeah.
So what is taking control of students or agitators or protesters when they engage in this sort of activity?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it's sort of, you know, how do you get mob behavior? How do you get groupthink? And this was very much at work here. What happened at Middlebury was a lot of students went to that protest, were not planning on doing what they did, but they saw some of their fellow students so outraged and morally anguished that this man was allowed to speak on campus, that they joined in. They joined in and did what everybody else was doing. So it was a real case study in the dangerous consequences of not thinking for yourself. And look, we're all social animals, right? We want to belong as well as to think for ourselves. But when you stop thinking, that's when the really dangerous things come. And when you shut down speech, I think it's really an invitation to violence, because it's through speech that we resolve our political differences, hopefully through reasoned dialogue. If you say, I disagree with you, I hate you, and you're not allowed to speak, what options are you giving that person for how to respond? Well, you can settle disputes through violence is one way you can do it. So I think it's really important in this country that we realize the importance of rational disagreement and, you know, realizing we're all humans who have different political opinions, but it's extraordinarily important to respect the humanity in everyone.
So we have this great tradition in our culture, and in our popular culture, we're taught constantly to think of ourselves as individuals, right, who have choices and preferences. And yet, in the young in particular, we see on some campuses a set of behavior that moves against that individualism in a really strong way.
Yeah.
Do you have thoughts about why that's happening?
Yeah, it's all well-intentioned, right? It's all well-intentioned, because some people are hurting and they're saying, you know, this is symbolic. When this person speaks, it's symbolic violence to me. You're a bad person if you're letting this person speak. But that's an extraordinarily disempowering thing for marginalized groups, you know, to say, you know, you are so upset that we've got to create a bubble around you rather than equipping you with the tools to defend yourself, to speak out, to expose arguments that make no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that makes me sad about it, is it's not really in the students' interests at all. That our job as educators should be to help them develop the tools to fight injustice in all its manifestations. But they're going to do that not through militant ideology. They're going to do that by through speech and argument.
How do you conduct your class so that you move the students in this direction?
Yeah.
What do you do as a teacher?
Well, I make a real point. I never had any of these problems in my classes. So this dramatic thing that I've told you about was completely unpredicted. You know, I never predicted it would happen. I was convinced until the last moment that I was going to persuade everybody this was a terrible idea of what they're doing. I was unsuccessful. This sometimes happens in life. You just have to take it. So what I do in my classes is I really say right from the start, look, we're all in here to learn. And if we're going to learn, we're going to have to speak our minds. We come from a diverse background, so if we speak our minds, there's a good chance we might offend somebody in the room. And that's okay. Because if somebody is offended, I want you to say that you are, and we can learn the reason why, and apologize and move on. But I don't want you self-censoring, because if you self-censor, you're not going to learn and grow. That's really at odds with liberal education. And the way we have discussions is through arguments and evidence, not calling each other names. So I have just ground rule, no ad hominem attacks. If anybody does that, I just stop it. I say, that's not an argument. I need an argument here. And the interesting thing is that I taught Charles Murray the bell curve in my class early on in my career.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if I told you this before.
No.
But it was a great, there was a symposium in the New Republic. If you're interested in this, you can Google it and look it up on Bell Curve New Republic. Ran in 1994. And it was just Charles Murray, Richard Herrnstein, and their critics. And I used to assign that to my students because it would get them so mad. And it was a great teaching device because they would get so angry, and then you could say to them, okay, you don't like the conclusion. Where does the argument go wrong? Is there a flawed assumption? Is there some error in logic? And get them to pinpoint exactly what they disagreed with. And then they are equipped with tools to argue with these arguments with which they disagree. This works the other way, actually. I don't know. I didn't tell you this either. But I actually taught a concert. I led a seminar through the Hudson Institute with some young conservatives in Washington. They invited me to do this. And the text that I selected was Brittany Cooper's Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. It's actually an excellent book.
that had a similar effect, I'm guessing.
It did. It was so fascinating. And then I could do the same thing. I could say, whoa, where does she say that? And she doesn't say the things they think she's saying?
Yeah.
And then got them to walk through it. And by the end, it was really kind of a wonderful experience. They had respect, deep respect for this woman. And the things she'd been through, and the insight she was putting on the table. That doesn't mean they have to agree with all her politics, but it just went to show me that this is not a left or right thing. This is a human thing.
Right.
We've all got our kind of biases, and education should help us overcome our biases to be more self-critical.
When some years ago, before I was at Baylor, when I was at Boston College, and I found that this is not necessarily an ideological thing, but it's teaching the history of ethics, and you start with ancient thought, medieval thought, modern, and then we would get up to Nietzsche, and I would find that many of the students in the class would only wake up, and they're bright students, they wrote good papers, but I was having a hard time to get them to engage with the arguments. And many of them had some sort of superficial Catholic education in their high schools. And so they thought they knew what Aristotle, Aquinas thought. Then they get to Nietzsche, and some of them would really like Nietzsche. It's sort of cool to read this kind of hip atheist who's attacking everything. But a number of them were shaken by it.
And really?
And I thought, and I started doing this, I started teaching the history of ethics backwards. So I historically backwards. I started with Nietzsche to try and get them shook up, so that they would think there was something they needed to worry about in the class. And then Nietzsche has this critique of the entire history of ethics, thinks it's all variations on a kind of fiction. So you'd say to them, well, okay, and I would really push Nietzsche. I would advocate to start the semester and then say, all right, well, you've got Nietzsche's argument. You've got his views of all these other people we're going to read. Let's go back and see whether he's right. And at least a significant portion of the class was much more engaged. Of course, it also had the effect, students think that the last person you read is the most recent. So many of them think Plato's a 20th century philosopher. And you know, of all the confusion students can have, that's not a bad one.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good.
But I think if you're serious about education, you want students, I mean, we talked about this earlier. Neither of us tries to hide our views in the class of what we think about things. But I always told students, this is my experience at the University of Dallas, that if you give a bad argument for the position that I hold, that's worse than if you give a good argument for a position I don't hold. And the students, if you grade them that way, they come to actually believe you. Mm-hmm. But you need certain kinds of techniques, I think, to get them to engage. And sometimes giving them something that gets them really worked up is a good way to start. You know, one of the other, I want to talk about the wider culture, but one other thing about college campuses, we have this experience of trigger warnings and safe spaces, which very much flow from the view that you were talking about earlier, that the idea is that students need to be protected from ideas or from images or whatever it might be that's put before them. What do you make of this phenomena of safe spaces? And so safe spaces is spaces where ideally no one gets offended, right? No one says anything offensive. And trigger warnings are that there's material in this book or whatever it is that we're going to be reading or studying that may be offensive. I mean, one could talk about a lot of different types of subject matter and whether trigger warnings are more appropriate in some areas than in others. And I think when you're using images and showing artwork and clips from films, there's something more potentially questionable about that than there would be about just reading a text. But so we could talk about all that, but what do you make just of the phenomenon of safe spaces and trigger warnings?
Well, we might differ on this a bit, because I obviously think that in the classroom, you know, a classroom can't be a safe space in the sense that you can't let ideas collide and liberal learning can't take place if people have to constantly be thinking about whether something they're going to say is going to offend someone.
Right.
That's not to say they should be offensive. There's no place for being offensive in a reasoned discussion, right? But I think that too much has been made about trigger warnings and safe spaces. To me, a trigger warning is basically being a little bit sensitive to the variety of people you would have in the room, and you know, it's just when you really think about how to practically implement it, it becomes absurd in some ways, right? Because, you know, most of European literature, a lot of it is anti-Semitic. Do you have to warn every Jewish student that, you know, around the corner is some anti-Semitism in this novel?
Right.
You know, when you really start parsing the different things that could offend people, you could spend the whole time, instead of learning and discussing, worrying about issuing the right statements. But I think being sensitive
In some places, there's an awful lot of time spent on that.
Some
universities.
And I think that's misplaced.
Yeah.
But being an empathetic human being and thinking about how the material might affect different students differently, that's just a good place to be. Because if someone's feeling disempowered or insulted or afraid, that is not a place where learning is going to take place, right? But the way to deal with that is just to be more of an empathetic human. With safe spaces, again, I think that's overblown too, the outrage about it, because what's a safe space? It's a place where people feel like they're with others who are like them, and so they feel, if they're some kind of minority group, that's a place they can retreat to. But what is Hill, you know, what is the Newman Society? Newman Society is a safe space, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because Catholics can congregate and they don't have to worry about, you know, the dominant culture making them feel like they don't belong.
Right.
Hillel is the same way. Mm-hmm. Now, I think, I don't know if this is true with the Newman Society, but I know with Hillel on some campus, you have non-Jewish leadership because these students want to join Hillel just to learn more about Jewish culture. Mm-hmm. I think that's a positive thing. But safe spaces are just...
Plato.
In the safe space. Yeah. See, a lot of that, though, you have to be careful, though, because there's a lot of caricaturing of what's going on in East Coast universities in some media that doesn't necessarily correspond with reality. There's plenty of wacky stuff out there. Don't get me wrong, but I feel like an emissary from the East Coast to tell you that. This is just a small fraction of opinion that gets amplified. There are lots of reasonable people like me. No, there really are more than you might think, so just keep that in mind. Yeah.
Yeah, you would want the classroom to be a safe space for argument.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that
yeah.
what we want? You mm-hmm. want it to be a place where, as you describe saying to your students, that you want them to feel free mm-hmm. to voice their opinions.
Yeah.
And if anyone feels slightly offended, they ought to check that and just listen to the argument.
Yeah, and especially the case in some of the elite institutions on the East Coast. I teach a course on American foreign policy. I am always on the lookout for Republican students. They want to hide usually. But if I find that they might be, I get very excited because this is my opportunity to really have spirited discussion in my class.
Right.
So I think you would see that in my class. But I know from some of these students that they feel like they can't really fully express their
right.
opinions. I think that's a terrible loss, so not just for them, but for the other students, because how do you make your argument better? Think of it, if you're a conservative on campus, you're potentially really going to be a lot smarter than the liberals on most college campuses because you constantly have to think about the alternative argument.
Mm-hmm.
And liberals could benefit from that as well. So
I worry that beneath or behind this whole phenomenon in our universities today is both two things. One, that it seems that universities as educational institutions have lost the trust of the general public and of the students mm-hmm. who are coming in. Because if the students trusted the education and the faculty, they would be more inclined to come to class and do what you're suggesting. I also mm-hmm. think there's a kind of despair about liberal education
yes.
in the culture that leads to a kind of skepticism. It might go both ways, but what's the point in doing this anyhow?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's all just a bunch of opinions, and I'm not going to make any progress finding the truth. I'm not going to be able to persuade people of my opinion. I mean, do you think that's right, that there's this sort of affliction of our universities that's connected to the culture surrounding them,
yep.
but has to do with a lack of trust and a lack of faith that liberal education is worthwhile?
Yeah, I agree with you, Tom, but I think I would push it even a little further. I think there's a lack of faith in American institutions.
Mm.
And this is a much deeper problem
right.
that what we're seeing on our university campuses is also present in the public at large.
Right.
And I know with my students, one of the things I'm so surprised about, and I'd like to teach them, is that they don't have any historical mm-hmm. or comparative context for critiquing the American political regime. In other words, they just look at what's happening now. They see all these ways we're falling short of our ideals, and it's just so horrible we should just blow it up.
Mm-hmm.
And my job is to make them realize, horrible compared to what, right? You know, understanding how the United States has progressed in becoming a more perfect union over time is extraordinarily important. And also seeing what, you know, politics looks like in other countries,
mm-hmm.
that is also instructive. But if you're lacking that, you can look around and see the problems and think it's just something intrinsically flawed with the American constitutional democracy itself. And that's enormously dangerous. I think this is true in the public at large right now, where mm-hmm. The idea of a system and the rule of law, and you have respect for those rules, and that is not a partisan issue, it's an American issue, is lost in the contemporary discussion. And we somehow have to recapture that, or we're going to lose something very precious.
Yeah, the sociologist James Hunter at the University of Virginia
yeah.
has done a lot of surveys and written a lot about this, and he talks about that all of our major institutions are suffering a legitimation crisis. So the presidency, Congress, media, our churches, our institutions of education, mm-hmm. their legitimacy is in question
mm-hmm.
in the culture at large, and especially among young people mm-hmm. who are quite skeptical of this institutional inheritance
yeah.
that we have. My goodness, how do we address that? How do yeah. we turn that around?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I'm spending a lot of time thinking about this because, in my view, you know, we really have to have a kind of second refounding. And what I mean by that is we have to come to terms with some of the gaps between our ideals and politics and practice. I'm just going to tell you one example that illustrates this. I got my PhD in government at Harvard. When I was there, there was one course that was required of all government majors at Harvard. It was called sophomore tutorial, but it was essentially American constitutional democracy. It started with a lot of political theory, you know, the Federalist Papers, the Constitution, Tocqueville, and it ended with Supreme Court cases. So you could see the whole thing in practice. And we went through the Civil War. And we had professors come in and lecture the teaching fellows on each of these segments, you know, how you should approach it. And I remember at the time, the relevant faculty member, Judith Schlar, telling us, your students are going to think that the Civil War was about slavery. Your job is to teach them that it wasn't.
Really?
Yeah. Now, why?
Yeah.
Because it was clear, if you read the documents of the Confederacy, it was about slavery, right? Let's just be honest. The reason, and it makes sense to me, is that if you fought that war and you wanted to keep the country together, you needed to focus on the higher principles that were evolved, states' rights and all these other things that were used to dress up the matter. Not that those aren't legitimate principles. And so what you have is a kind of whitewashing of American history where you're not dealing with some of the uglier aspects, and that's what students are onto. Uh-huh. That, you know, the hashtag OK Boomer meme, you know, about OK Boomer? Have you heard that?
No.
Oh, it's the meme called OK Boomer. It's basically making fun of boomers who want to sort of excuse themselves for the mess they've made. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the response is just, OK Boomer, like, sure, lecture me. How can you lecture me? Look at this mess you've made.
Yeah.
And I think the way we deal with that is to acknowledge our history and our flaws, both our achievements and our flaws. And that's going to require kind of a, in my view, we can disagree about this, a reckoning with race in the United States that has not been had yet. And I think there are a number of positive ways to do that. But I think a lot of the anguish that led to this unfortunate event in Middlebury is tied to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know myself, I've learned all these new things I didn't know before. There's a great book by Ibram X. Kendi that won the National Book Award. It's called Stamp from the Beginning, A Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. That's really worth reading because it is just horrifying how it looks from that perspective. And that's what we're dealing with. And the way you deal with that is you've got to listen to the concerns, acknowledge your faults, and then hopefully move forward together as one people or one nation.
This is a really good point. So you had in a previous generation and even up to and through Toni Morrison, who just recently died, you had a really profound and deeply historical informed African-American literature. Ellison, Baldwin, and we think of these great American African-American writers who thought that was precisely what we needed, was a deeper reckoning with history, but in all its complexity.
Exactly.
In all its complexity on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
And now some of the people on the left who would call themselves the heirs of those folks, but as you say, often haven't read them, at least among the young, want, in a sense, to just get rid of history.
Yes.
And so it's not just on, you might say, the white right, that there's a forgetfulness of race and the history, but in the name, in a sense, of remembering race, there's a push to just discard all of the past.
Yeah.
How do you account for that? And it seems like a really bad idea on all sides.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it is a really bad idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like this really vexing problem because, okay, take Charles Murray, the bell curve. What were people upset about? They were upset because he showed that statistically there were these IQ differences among different races. And that is a toxic thing to point out, given the history of the United States and how that was used. But at the same time, that same history probably helps explain why we have such racial inequality in America, right? That's a pretty serious legacy with which to reckon. So you're in this really curious position of, on the one hand, you know, if you bring up some of these disparities, it can be seen as racist. But at the same time, if you're going to address the disparities to make America a more equal place, you have to acknowledge the disparities as something wrong, right? Does that make any sense? So, So I think it's just a really interesting, vexing thing to think about, especially in a big data world where we have all these algorithms. Because you might want to say, we shouldn't even collect data about race, because race is a social construct. It will just get reified, and you'll see further discrimination in these different algorithms. And there's evidence to that. But if we don't collect data about race, how are we going to address discrimination? Do you see that? You see the little? Are we under attack? Have I said something wrong? Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's
I think also it's interesting that my view about liberal education in America is that we don't have a lot of really good articulations of liberal education as loving learning for its own sake.
Yeah, that's a good point.
For the sake of pondering what W.B. Du Bois calls the riddle of existence. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of sort of instrumental views like Benjamin Franklin and then Dewey.
Yeah.
And my own view is that the best writers about liberal education in America are African American authors. So Frederick Douglass's account of his own education on the streets of Baltimore when he's being held as a slave and is sort of having contests with the white kids in the street learning how to spell words and expanding his vocabulary and how that gave him deep insight into his own capacity to learn and into his full humanity. Du Bois's essay in The Souls of Black Folk on liberal education, I think is about the finest thing ever written by an American.
Exactly.
On liberal education. So I think it's actually, because liberal education literally means to be led into freedom. Mm-hmm. We have a really simplistic view of freedom in our country. It's a kind of consumerist view of freedom. And so if you don't start out thinking that you're unfree in some ways and that you need education to make you free, to free you from your bondage and your blindness, then you don't need it. But African-American authors who have struggled with the complexity of external oppression and the way in which that can influence internal, how one sees oneself, they are much more sophisticated about this question of freedom.
That's really true. Yeah, I just got a little chill when you said that, because there's this very good documentary, Ken Burns documentary, that's going to air November 25th. It's on the Barred Prison Initiative. I'm a senior policy fellow at the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College. So I went to see the screening. And Bard has this extensive network of liberal education in prisons. They can earn an associate's degree or a college degree from Bard. And this documentary illustrates this so dramatically, because these are incarcerated individuals who discover in the worst possible circumstances that liberal learning is freedom. They can be in jail, and they have their minds and what they've learned, and nobody can, education is one of the few things in life that nobody can take away from you.
Yep.
They can take away, your relationships, they can throw you in jail, they can strip you of everything you own, but that education is yours forever for keeps. And you see this in these young men and women in prison. And how powerful that is, and how it makes them almost evangelists for empathy. You know?
Right.
Why? I'll give you one little... I spoke in Tampa last week at the School of Social Work. You might wonder, why would they invite her to the School of Social Work at the University of Southern Florida?
They have good taste.
Yeah. It was really fascinating, because these formerly incarcerated individuals who are now teaching others to be social workers were keenly aware of the necessity of forgiveness in their own journey. They've committed felonies. They want to be given a second chance. That is directly connected to the sort of forgiveness we have to have with one another in less complicated circumstances. And it was very moving to me that they saw me as part of their struggle, and that meant a lot to me, given I've been called a white supremacist. You know, so...
Yeah.
Well, watch that documentary. It's unbelievable. Really great. It'll make you cry.
There's so much there. I mean, I wonder, in that last point, you mentioned Hannah Arendt. It's interesting that writers who reckoned with totalitarianism and then Nazism wrote most deeply about liberal education. They had a sense of why it really mattered to have the freedom to think deeply about what it means to be human. The last point you made, though, and then I want to turn to your book and the contemporary scene, forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have a culture that's bent on certain forms of justice, and particularly justice as a kind of retribution. Where is forgiveness? Why is that not as much of a part? Again, with the authors we talked about earlier, I mean, think about Martin Luther King, right? Huge influence just 50 years ago. But that side of our social discourse of forgiveness seems to have vanished.
It really has. I mean, that's the whole essence of the call-out culture, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're a bad human being. Not just, I don't like your argument, but I'm going to cancel you. You're done. Yeah. No human being should be canceled. You know,
right.
Unless they're involved in dominating and killing other human beings. I'm all for canceling dictators.
Yeah.
But other humans,
yeah.
We have to give them the benefit of the doubt, and that does involve forgiveness.
Yeah.
And I think it also involves... apologies from the powerful. The thing I'm really surprised about is when people aren't willing to apologize. That usually to me is a red flag that this person has some kind of sense of entitlement that needs to be addressed. This is, you know, it's very hard for some people to apologize.
Yeah.
And I think if you've offended another human being, even if you think they're overly sensitive, the gracious thing to do is to say you're sorry and then move on.
Right.
But we're all often... too unwilling to do that. But it's great. I forgive the people who hurt me. I'm free. I'm not burdened by hatred.
Right.
I can go out and do good in the world. And we're all like that. It's horrible to have a lot of hatred inside you. You can do it for yourself and not just for others.
So
yeah.
Let's talk about, because the book is not unrelated.
No.
to the topics we're discussing. Before, I know we're going to turn to questions in a moment, but let's say a little bit about lessons for our culture and about free and open debate and commitment to truthfulness that you've learned from your work many years in the making here.
Yeah, on 7 years in the making.
Yeah.
Now, well, whistleblowers, the connection is pretty simple. Whistleblowers speak truth to power. They commit truth. They expose things that the powerful have blinders on that they don't see. They see a gap between ideals and reality, and they speak out. And they often suffer tremendously for doing so, because guess what? You know, nobody likes someone who is looking at the status quo, and everybody else is saying, this is just fine. And the whistleblower is saying, it's not just fine. You say you believe this. You say these are your rules. You're actually doing something else. That's not fine. But that's hard to do because you're considered not to be a team player. But it's vitally important for American democracy. And what I do in my book is really show how whistleblowing is American. That this whole issue of whistleblowing is not a partisan issue, it's an American issue, which is why you had unanimous agreement in the United States Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, that whistleblower complaint should be turned over to Congress. And that's because, at least in the realm of theory, we're all about whistleblowers. Because we're the new republic, right? We broke with Britain in part because we saw them as utterly corrupt hypocrites. They had one set of rules for themselves, another set of rules for the colonies. And we rose up and formed a new republic. And the founders were keenly interested in putting in place a system through the separation of powers where you would not see this sort of corruption again. So that's why we have the world's first whistleblower protection law, which dates back to 1778. I can go on and on about this. But it's a fascinating story, and what you see is how important whistleblowers are in a sense kind of... When the American ship of state is about to go off the rails, there have been whistleblowers who have pulled it back. So if you're looking at the present circumstance and thinking this is utterly hopeless, you can read my book and feel a little bit better, because we've been in terrible situations before, and Congress has legislated in response to the abuse of power and other such things to get us back on track. But the first, anybody know who America's first, Americans first blew the whistle on that led to the law? Someone could have blown the whistle on Jefferson. He had a few, in fact, I begin the book with two quotes. The first one is from Thomas Jefferson. "The whole art of government consists in the art of being honest." Thomas Jefferson. And the next quote, and I had to get permission from the James Baldwin estate to use this and juxtapose it with Jefferson, and I'm extremely proud of that, because they said this is a good thing to do. Quote from Baldwin is, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." So that's a
great quote.
That's a great quote. Great juxtaposition. But first Commodore of the U.S. Navy, Essex Hopkins, is responsible for the first whistleblower protection law. You know what he did? Just going to drop this little story on you and then turn it over to questions.
I'm going to fail the civics quiz here.
No. Nobody knew. No, this is a contribution to my book. Nobody knew this. You know how I found it out? Through research, and a lot of the founding documents have been digitized, and I searched on keywords and found this out. So this is I'm going to be published in the Journal of Military History for this, just so you know.
Excellent.
Because Hopkins, George Washington would say, "Commodore Hopkins, take the U.S. Navy to the Chesapeake Bay and engage the British." And you know what that man would do? He'd take the U.S. Navy to the Bahamas. Do you know why? He was all involved in the slave trade. Rhode Island was and not that he was running slaves at this moment. He had given up actually running slaves. But his commercial interest was driving his use of the U.S. Navy. So he was exploiting his public office for private gain.
Yeah.
And Congress said, no way. They passed whistleblower protection. They paid the legal fees of the whistleblowers, because the two Rhode Islanders got thrown in jail. And they also legislated that all those documents had to be made available to the public, which is why we can even tell this story today. So whistleblowing is American.
That's great.
It's not partisan.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
That is something. Wow.
Lots of fun things in there.
I bet. I'm looking forward to reading this.
I also interviewed Snowden. All the NSA whistleblowers, but get this, since we're talking about rational disagreement, the entire senior leadership of the NSA. That was hard to do.
That sounds hard to do.
Yeah, so you had these two narratives that had nothing in common.
Can we talk later about sourcing and how I can
that? Yeah.
Well, we're not done yet. So yeah. I know people might have some questions.
Yeah.
Just one request from the reporter: make your question a question. That would make it easier. And then I think we'll just raise hands, and then we have some of our University of Dallas students have microphones. So the gentleman here. Can I ask you to use the mic, just because we'll pick it up on, we're recording this. Thank you.
How well received do you think William Buckley would be at Middlebury College?
Today? Do you want to take that?
No, well, it's your home base.
Jump on.
Well, it's a tough question, because on the one hand, he always had this very affected manner, so that would have put off some of the students. But on the other hand, he also said that he'd rather be governed by the first 500 names in the Boston phone book than by tenured members of the Harvard faculty. And I think students would like that quote. So, yeah, he was an interesting man.
Would he be the same lightning rod?
Students wouldn't even know who he was. Even though all the old episodes of Firing Line have been resurrected.
Yeah.
You know what? That's really fun to do, Tom. If you watch them, they're from 30 years ago.
Yeah.
They're talking about the same things. It just never goes away.
Yeah.
It's all... political correctness and
It's a higher level discussion than you often see on TV today.
Yeah, they're good. They're good episodes. I love them, actually.
You could see them like I remember watching the one where he's interviewing Woody Allen, and you could see them getting angry at one another a little bit. But then the response to that was to try and one up the other person with a more clever insult.
Yeah.
Right? That was also something really smart. So they wanted to go at each other and were angry at each other. But I guess it's only in the Gore Vidal conversation that things came to fisticuffs. But most of the time, it's a conversation where you can see them, when they get angry, they take up their intellectual...
That's a good point.
The whole intellectual debate goes up a notch.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, I'm going to show this guy that my position is smarter, and I'm smarter than he is or she is.
Yeah.
And that's not our first instinct today.
Yeah, I so miss that.
Yeah.
I really miss that. Yeah. Let's resurrect violence.
There's a gentleman in the front here.
I live in a suburban district here in the Metroplex. Mm-hmm. And the inclusion and equity program in that district has been hijacked by the message of DeLangelo's White Fragility book. And so all of a sudden now, every white person in the district is a irredeemable racist. The United States is a institutional racist. Capitalism is bad. Socialism is good. Mm-hmm. Cops are bad. Military is bad. My question to you is, how concerned are you that what is going on in high schools around the country is the same thing that's going on in colleges and universities, and yet it's off the radar?
Yeah.
How concerned are you?
You can start. Please.
I'm concerned, and I think civic education is in a dismal state in this country. And I'm actually involved at the center I'm at Harvard, Danielle Allen, if that name means anything to you. She is involved in revamping the curriculum for Massachusetts public schools, and in a very intelligent way, in that she's discovering all these things that students can read from African Americans that they never read before, but at the same time she's fiercely committed to the constitutional project. She's got a great piece coming out in the next issue of The Atlantic if you want to see her vision. But this is a real problem. Students don't know anything. They don't know anything. This is something I'm really concerned about, because there's this obsession with STEM. You know, STEM is great. I was a math major. It teaches you to think, to do math. But what STEM doesn't give you is any historical context. It doesn't give you any ethical context. It doesn't give you any comparative context, and that's dangerous when it comes to things like common sense.
Yeah, there's a great, I give a plug for my university and the paper. There's a great op-ed this morning in the Dallas Morning News about the importance of the learning of languages to supply all of those things that you just mentioned. And one of the paradoxes of our time in higher education is that there's a drumbeat about diversity, and yet we're getting rid of foreign languages almost entirely.
I know.
And it is in something like learning to translate your own experience into someone else's language or their experience into your language.
Yeah.
And of course, the way to do that is to wrestle with conjugations and declensions and then to learn to actually read and talk in another language. That's the way in which you learn to have a second first language, right? When you can get the jokes in another language, you know you're on your way to mastering it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sympathy that you develop for, and then you see your original language quite differently. I think I learned grammar really only fully, English grammar, when I took Latin in college and had to learn how to translate it back. And then I think that helped me with my English writing, but I saw my own first language in a quite different way, and this is the sort of thing that liberal education ought to be about.
Yes.
And we're not doing a good job at any level, really.
Gentleman here.
Well,
this terrible divide where we can't talk is fairly recent. What, 10 years? What made it happen?
Yeah. Tell us that, please.
You know, there's a crisis in the humanities in this country. The humanities have been politicized. Yeah. And, you know, ideology, in my view, has no place in a classroom.
Right.
Because what is ideology? It's like a recipe book of what you're supposed to think.
Yep.
It's the opposite of thinking for yourself. And what's great to me about this country is we're the ultimate expression of think for yourself, right? That whole project, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, that was pretty innovative at the time. You know, you're not going to come up with something as glorious as that if you're just slavishly imitating someone else.
Yeah.
But
in the wider culture, too, right? We've got a decline in what you might call civic friendship. Just affability between and among Americans. There seems to be a tendency to want very quickly to label in-group, out-group, and to have a kind of belonging, mm-hmm. whether this is on social media or wherever, that's through an identification with an ideology.
Exactly.
Rather than with the people you physically live with.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's a dangerous thing. It's a kind of weird abstraction from the world we're living in. We go to social media, we go to abstractions about politics, instead of engaging with the people we live and work with.
Mm-hmm. I really think I'm involved with something called the Washington Interfaith Network in Washington, D.C. And I think this is actually coalitions of faith-based communities across religious divides right. are actually an extraordinarily powerful means of reviving community.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anything like that is going on in Dallas, but that is the way to go. Because what do you see in a church or a synagogue or a mosque? You usually see all sorts of different types of people from different walks of life, different classes, different neighborhoods, and they get together and they're...
Dallas Institute just hosted a series on this.
Really?
Very topic.
Yeah.
Please,
if you're a person of faith, get out there and do something about this. We're the future.
Gentleman here in the front.
Yeah, you spoke earlier about safe spaces, trigger warnings, and almost that was untypical mm-hmm. of what is going on. Among the things I read, essays, Quillette, Spiked, mm-hmm. and a few other places that seem to paint a darker picture. And also Heterodox Academy, which mm-hmm. I'm not just completely up to date with, but I understand what it's about. So I'm wondering how literally to take you when you say it's not quite as grim as it may appear. Would you say some more on that, please?
Okay, full disclosure, I'm like a glass half full person.
Okay.
I always take a more optimistic view of things because I think if we want to actually make the world a better place, you've got to believe that perhaps you can. The alternative means you never get to a better place. But I'm a bad person to ask about Middlebury because I haven't been there for 3 years. Okay, but I can tell you at Harvard, it's very impressive what's going on in Princeton, where I've spoken.
Yeah.
And Bard College is an amazing place. This is the college that does the prison initiative. When there's leadership that takes a firm stand on this, you get a very different...
Right. Well, the president of Princeton has been very public about this.
Yeah, you get
matter.
A very different environment than when you have presidents who are politicians mm-hmm. who... Just let this be a lesson to you.
Thank you.
It's just the easy way out, right?
I'm a rookie. I got a lot to learn.
No, you know this. This is the easy way out.
Yes.
To just appease all the different factions.
Right.
But if you don't stand for something, you're not going to have any authority.
What's the point in doing the job?
And there's no point in doing the job. So we need more people like Tom Hibbs at the helms of our universities.
But isn't that the point of what happened at Harvard with the two professors who got pilloried because they took the wrong stand on Halloween costumes?
What was that? No, that
was
Yale.
I think he's referring to the Yale incident with Nicholas Christakis.
Yeah, Yale. Yeah, okay. Yale, a little bit different at Yale. Yale Law School is going off the rails a little bit, but Yale's different. But it's, so, but there are these. I think the tide is turning on this because it's easy for intelligent people to see how what's going on our college campuses is linked to what's going on in the larger political sphere. Because if we can't get it right on our college campuses, how are we going to get it right out there? I think there's a growing awareness that that's the case. And we're going to see educators making an effort to.
Well, and I think it is, you said this earlier about interfaith conversations. I think mm-hmm. it is on many religious campuses now that you're seeing, they've watched what's going on elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I just love Baylor where rational disagreement, our friends Cornell West and Robbie George will be there the end of this week to talk about civil disagreement. It's certainly something you've got our flyer in the back, Scott Kreider, professor at the University of Dallas, about rules for civil, rational, deep disagreement.
Yeah.
I think there's an opportunity for private schools and faith-based institutions to kind of take the lead on this and to model for other universities and the wider culture how we ought to do this.
I think you're extraordinarily wise because this is a highly important thing to provide, and there's definitely a chance to take away market share because these elite institutions cost so much too, right? People may start voting with their feet. I think that's already starting to happen.
Maybe one more question, and I see the lady here.
Is there anything you can share with us about Edward Snowden and whistleblowing?
Sure, I could go on and on about him.
Let's end with a good story from the book.
What's a good story?
Well, but do you have a good Snowden story?
So here's how I interview Edward Snowden.
Okay, cool.
This will tell you something about me. Bad or good, I'm not sure. So the whole Charles Murray thing happened to me on March 2nd. I was scheduled to interview Edward Snowden on March 17th. You know, I was in pretty bad shape. I was still in a neck brace, and I had to wear sunglasses because the light was bothering me. But I was determined to interview Edward Snowden. So the deal was that I would get to do a private interview with him beforehand, and then we would do the public event. And so we had a big screen because he's in Moscow, and he beams up on the screen, and I say, "Hello, Mr. Snowden," and he just bursts out laughing at me because I've got these sunglasses on, I've got a neck brace on. Like, you've got it worse than I do. But anyway, so
did he ask what prison you were being held in?
Yeah. And anyway, so he was very forthcoming, very impressive. And the interesting thing I would just tell you that let's just put it this way. Government officials say one thing when they're in office, and they can say another thing elsewhere. And what I would point out to you is that Chris Inglis, who was the number two at the NSA, was saying while he was at the NSA, and this was the standard line, you know, he's in the pocket of the Russians. The Russians, he's got to be a Russian operative. And Chris Inglis has since said, and this is a conclusion I also reached in my own research, that he thinks he acted independently. In other words, getting out of office, he basically confirmed what I had concluded through interviewing both sides and really thinking about it, that this was someone acting on principle, not some foreign agent acting to subvert the United States. And, you know, I could be wrong. With anything with intelligence, there's always the chance there's going to be some new bit of information revealed. But in my book, I argue that I think Edward Snowden might one day be viewed as America's first traitor patriot. In other words, he really broke the law by releasing those documents, but he showed the American people that emergency measures that were taken after 9/11 at the NSA, rightfully so, had simply become business as usual over time without any discussion amongst the American people. And he forced that conversation, and I think in so doing, he arguably did a public service. So,
fantastic. Well, this has been everything I could have hoped for and more, and I know I have a lot to think about. As I mentioned, Dr. Stanger will be signing her book, Whistleblower, and so join us for that. Otherwise, please, let's give these two a round of applause. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Dallas. It's a nice place to be.